Hello, I'm Rockin' Ron Schumacher. I host Middays on 103.5 WGRR, Cincinnati's greatest hits, including playing your lunchtime greats by request Monday through Friday between noon and 1. Excited to be back as your Hollywood reporter again this week. Latest news from Tinseltown, courtesy of Entertainment Weekly magazine. September is a double issue with The Crown's Olivia Colman on the cover and the title The New Queen of Hollywood. We kick off this latest edition with the must list, the top 10 things we love this month. And at number 10, from TV, The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. Geflings, Skeksis, and other quirky puppet species are alive and well and living off of Netflix's money, thanks to the streamer's epic prequel series to Jim Henson and Frank Oz's 80s film Fable. As fantastical as the characters is the cast list, names like Taron Egerton, Mark Hamill, Helena Bonham Carter, and Sigourney Weaver, who bring fresh voices to the title, while stunning visuals and storytelling bring fresh eyeballs to it. Make way for one buzzy, fuzzy, gloriously geeky celebration of peak TV. The 100-word history of a cult classic. You know, in 1982, Henson and Oz's The Dark Crystal wasn't a massive hit with critics or audiences. Many families found it not friendly at all, but Henson considered it his most personal film, and over time, it summoned a devoted following fueled by home entertainment releases, convention appearances, and collector's merchandise, including, for some reason, a line of perfumes. The Jim Henson Company spent years developing a movie sequel prior to the deal for prequel series, which CEO Lisa Henson hopes will last multiple seasons, and calls the thing I'm most proud of that we've done since her father's death. At number 9, it's podcasts, The Three Questions with Andy Richter. Every celebrity guest on this fledgling but promising weekly podcast must answer three key questions. Where do you come from? Where are you going? And what have you learned? From those simple queries come thoughtful, revealing conversations about life, showbiz success, and more, with Conan's mainstay Andy Richter proving himself as unafraid to open up as his guests, who thus far have included Amy Sedaris, Natasha Lyonne, and Mayim Bialik, all worthy passengers, you'll find, on a commute to wherever it is you may be going. At number 8, we return to TV. It's Buried Treasures, the best stuff you totally missed. Los Espookies, written by Kristen Baldwin, Entertainment Weekly TV critic. HBO's Los Espookies was an easy show to let slip by, a Spanish-language comedy about horror nerds starring no one you recognize and Fred Armisen. Who has the time? But my biggest TV viewing mistake of 2019 was initially overlooking this charming gem created by writer-actors Julio Torres and Ana Fabrega. The duo, played by Andreas and Tati, two horror enthusiasts who join forces with their friends Ursula and Ronaldo to stage creepy and gore-tastic scenes for paying customers. Surreal, sweet, and rapid-fire funny, Los Espookies, just renewed for season 2, is like a half-hour telenovela assembled in the 30 Rock writers' room. At number 7 on the must list, according to Entertainment Weekly magazine this month, it's music. Lana Del Rey. Pop self-dubbed 24/7 Sylvia Plath blesses the masses with a new album after 2017's exceptionally lofty Lust for Life. With its pearl clutcher of a title, expect Del Rey's Norma Effing Rockwell to continue the singer's career-long exploration of America's glamorous and gritty underbelly. Early singles like the wispy ballad Venice Bitch and the Leonard Cohen-esque Mariner's Apartment Complex, which hands Del Rey's California Cool to top producer Jack Antonoff for their first collaboration, promise that Del Rey is keen to quench her fans' saltwater thirst for late summertime sadness, just in time for the seasons to start a-changing. Lana Americana. Oh, say, can you see all the ways the singer embraces the USA from scene to shining scene? There was the Hollywood sign. Well, Del Rey stood atop the infamous industry sign in her 2017 duet with The Weeknd, Lust for Life. There was Marilyn Monroe. In Tropico, Del Rey saluted the film legend alongside Elvis Presley and Jesus right where she belongs. There was the American flag. Del Rey often references our national banner, never more so than in the video for Born to Die. There's the Kennedys. Del Rey created her own diorama of the doomed first family with A$AP Rocky in National Anthem. And then there's Levi's, or related denim. She named a song Blue Jeans, then showed a dude stripping out of them. A true American hero. At number six, we spotlight books in The Institute by Stephen King. The prolific prose master's latest novel tracks child prodigy Luke Ellis, who is orphaned and then kidnapped by a secret organization that deposits him in an establishment for kids with supernatural powers. The result is both a King-worthy page-turner and a sobering reminder that in fiction and in reality, imprisoning kids is a horrifying act. Ranking at number five, it is The Stage in Betrayal. Marvel's resident god of mischief is sowing discord on a very different stage. Before stepping back into the role of Loki for his just-announced Disney Plus series, Tom Hiddleston will make his Broadway debut in a revival of Harold Pinter's classic play, Betrayal, this month. The oft-revived drama uses reverse chronology to spin the story of a marriage unraveled by a wife's years-long affair with her husband's close friend. Here, Broadway's latest leading man tells Entertainment Weekly's Jessica Dershowitz about giving New York audiences something quite new to marvel at. In this question-and-answer session, Entertainment Weekly asks Tom, "What was it about Betrayal that interested you?" And he replied, "I find this play fascinating. It's about the complexity of relationships, the profound commitment to trust, about knowledge, about time. And what's thrilling about it, for my co-stars, Charlie Cox and Zoe Ashton, and myself, is none of us leave the stage. There's a charge between the three of us that we hope reveals something new about the play. That these three relationships, the marriage, the friendship, and the affair, are actually codependent. And when one breaks down, they all break down." Entertainment Weekly asks, "Why has this 1978 play endured the way it has?" And Tom says, "It's strange how it continues to feel modern, because the play is also about loneliness and trying to connect. These are enduring themes, and I don't think these are human characteristics that are going out of fashion anytime soon." Entertainment Weekly asks, "Do you remember the first Broadway show you saw?" And Tom replies, "I think it might have been Follies. I saw Samuel L. Jackson and Angela Bassett do The Mountaintop, James Gordon in One Man, Two Governors. I remember coming to shoot the last 3 days of Avengers in New York, and the Book of Mormon had just opened, but we were all trying to get a ticket, and we couldn't get one. Not even the Avengers could get in. That's how big a hit it was." And the final question from Entertainment Weekly to Tom Hiddleston, "You're doing a Loki series for Disney Plus. When do things begin on that front?" He said, "Loki will start at the top of next year. He's such a classical character, Thor and Loki. They're from Norse myths. They have a kind of gravitas to them. Robert in Betrayal is much more earthbound. They're both very complex, but Robert is a publisher and a husband and a father. Loki is the god of mischief. Two quite different figures." At number four, it spotlights books in Year of the Monkey by Patti Smith. The wild success of 2010's National Book Award-winning Just Kids made Smith an unlikely literary star. Now the dreamlike anecdotes in the punk poet's latest memoir unfold more like the stack of old Polaroids she finds in a box in her New York apartment. One after another, each a talisman on a necklace of continuous travels, Monkey might not have kids' string of famous names or electric youth in revolt energy, but the slim volume's lovely minor key melancholy still gets under the skin. Continuing with the must list from this month's Entertainment Weekly magazine, we're up to number three. It features games in World of Warcraft Classic. World of Warcraft shook up online gaming when it launched back in 2004, but that multiverse has changed quite a bit since then. In the past 15 years, the field has become crowded with entertaining fantasy epics. But World of Warcraft never lost its diehard fans, who have stuck by the PC game through endless dragon cataclysms and anthropomorphic panda takeovers. For those who will accept no substitutes, the surprisingly fresh World of Warcraft Classic allows players to revert the game to its original mid-2000s form when it cast a digital spell over hordes of sword and sorcery-loving teens. Time to decide whether that powerful nostalgia hit is worth losing another million hours of your life. We're up to number two, and it's a return to TV in Hyperdrive. Our go-to pitch is American Ninja Warrior meets Fast and Furious, which I think nails it on the head. Executive producer Charlize Theron says of her new Netflix competition series, in which elite street racers from around the world test their limits on a 100-acre automotive obstacle course. This show takes you on a wild ride, the racing enthusiast continues. 1 minute you're on the edge of your seat watching a car balance on a giant teeter-totter 100 feet in the air, and the next you're about to bawl your eyes out hearing these competitors' incredible backstories. You haven't seen anything like this, trust me. And if you don't trust her, trust us. This high-thrill show jam-packed with real-life Hot Wheel stunts will get your motor running, according to Patrick Gomez of Entertainment Weekly. And Charlize's need for speed? Well, there's something about driving fast that just gives you an adrenaline rush you can't get anywhere else, gushes Theron, who is 44 years of age. And her on-screen racing resume includes Fast and Furious 9, Mad Max Fury Road, and The Italian Job. She says, when I was a kid in South Africa, my neighbors and I used to race around in homemade go-karts. And that's when I first became obsessed with driving, says the Oscar winner. I'm a bit of a competition junkie, so I love a good race. It probably stems from my days racing the neighborhood boys and beating them, mostly. Well, we've been counting down the must list, the top 10 things we love this month. In the latest issue of Entertainment Weekly magazine, we're at number one. It returns to TV in On Becoming a God in Central Florida. This article written by Joey Nolfi. Kirsten Dunst connects while driving through the worst pocket of cell reception in California. She shares your prayer that we get through this. We are together, she coos reassuringly. Minutes later, she cuts out. Behold the continued queen of the unexpected. An acting veteran at the age of 37, Dunst has made a career of surprising audiences with untraditional turns in offbeat dramas. She played a rebel royal in Marie Antoinette, art house gems like A Bride Whose Depression Wills the Apocalypse in Melancholia, and even blockbusters, minimizing damsel Mary Jane's distress in 3 Spider-Man films. Now she continues her singular streak on Showtime's dark comedy On Becoming a God in Central Florida, playing Crystal Stubbs, an Orlando-adjacent water park employee, with a wardrobe best described as Lisa Frank dabbling in textiles, forced into conning her way up the ranks of a pyramid scheme in the wake of tragedy. She's cutthroat, but with a heart of gold, says Dunst, who lends her cool, inviting calmness to Crystal's vengeful rage, even as her mama bear survivalistic tactics grow increasingly bonkers. Within 2 episodes of this 90-set series, a wailing Crystal fires a shotgun at a swamp of alligators, then skins and hand-harvests the meat to feed her young. It's about a mother trying to make it work, Dunst chirps. For the producer and star, making things work meant anchoring herself to the series through multiple network handoffs, first at AMC, then YouTube, then Showtime. I couldn't let this character go, she says, savoring Crystal's agency amid other offers the actress has received to play helpless 30-somethings crying about some man. Crystal marks the latest benchmark in Dunst's mission to resist the Hollywood blonde stereotypes. She values complex renegades, which drew her to the new creative freedom of TV to perform juicy roles, like on 2015's Fargo, that she rarely sees in film. I wanted to be more of an artist in my acting, instead of making tons of money being a star of every big whatever. About her string of studio rom-coms in the late aughts, she admits, I hated that kind of acting. Thank God Sofia Coppola would sweep me away to do a Marie Antoinette in between. So what's next? Florida could be a hit, or Dunst may focus on producing to allow more time with her infant son. But her plan isn't clear, and it never has been. Whether weird or wonderful, all we know is we're going to get through it together. That's the must list. Now we're taking a look at Hollywood True Crime, His Dark Places. Bob Crane made millions of viewers laugh as the star of Hogan's Heroes, but his easy smile masked the sexual obsession that may have led to his murder. This article written by Lynette Rice. Ugly things don't generally happen in Scottsdale. The wealthy exurb of Phoenix drowses in the heat of the Sonoran Desert, sprinkled with luxury resorts catering to snowbirds and what Arizonans call the Valley of the Sun. It was June 29, 1978, likely began as nearly all Scottsdale summer days do. Temperatures soared above 100 degrees by high noon, and well-heeled residents took refuge in their heavily air-conditioned villas, leaving the wide streets as empty as any southwest ghost town. It didn't end that way, though. Responding to a call from one of the city's apartment complexes, local cops happened on a very un-Scottsdale tableau. In a dimly lit first-floor apartment, they found the battered body of a shirtless 49-year-old man sprawled in bed with two huge gashes above his left ear and an electrical cord knotted around his neck. It was clear he had been in good shape and had salt and pepper hair, but gore obliterated most other details. Blood was splattered over the wall and ceiling. There was so much of it, the victim's pillow was drenched crimson. After learning the flat was leased to the nearby Windmill Dinner Theater, police asked the theater's manager, Ed Beck, to identify the corpse. "There was no way I could identify him from one side," Beck told the press. "The other side? Yes." The bludgeoned form had once been Bob Crane, a TV star known to millions as the wisecracking title character on the 1960s sitcom Hogan's Heroes. Crane's grisly murder revealed he had been doing a very different sort of on-camera work behind closed doors. Four decades later, the still unsolved slaying of the enigmatic actor, with its links to a netherworld of sex addiction and pornography, has spawned a 2002 movie, at least five books, three investigations, and a vast spider's web of speculation. The seamy side of Crane's life is no mystery. His obsession with sex damaged his career and possibly got him killed. The actor's son, Robert, recalls that his father's dressing room was Porn Central, where the stars stored Polaroids, negatives, and X-rated films. Long before he met his end on the edge of Phoenix, Bob Crane had plunged from the heights of Hollywood into a particularly seedy showbiz hell. But for those who loved him, it's the unanswered questions that are haunting. "There's still fog," says Robert, the 68-year-old author of Sex, Celebrity, and My Father's Unsolved Murder. "And when I say fog, it's that word closure, which I hate. But there is no closure. You live with death for the rest of your life." In the 1960s, sitcoms with lame jokes punctuated by a bad laugh track were the norm. But only one dared to mix that cheesiness with bumbling Nazis. Yet when it debuted on CBS in the fall of 1965, Hogan's Heroes was an overnight hit. Very loosely inspired by World War II movies like The Great Escape, which was released in 1963, Heroes featured a motley crew of inmates in a German prisoner of war camp outfoxing a remarkable inept Third Reich for six seasons. Along the way, it made Crane, who played the womanizing Colonel Robert Hogan, a household name. Before going in front of the camera, the Connecticut-born Crane made his name as a radio host, interviewing Marilyn Monroe, Bob Hope, and Charlton Heston on CBS's L.A. flagship station, KNX. After legendary TV writer Carl Reiner appeared on Crane's radio show, he gave the broadcaster a guest gig as a philandering husband on the Dick Van Dyke Show. That led to a regular spot as a happy-go-lucky dentist on the Donna Reed Show. When his agent sent Crane the script for Heroes, the actor mistook it for a drama. "Bob, what are you talking about?" the agent said, according to Robert's 2015 book about his dad. "This is a comedy. These are the funny Nazis." Well, Crane wasn't the only one who was confused. World War II had ended a mere 20 years before the sitcom's premiere, a genocidal trauma within the living memory of millions. Making matters even more bizarre, three of Hero's funny fascists, Werner Klemperer, who played Colonel Klink, John Boehner, who played Sergeant Schultz, and Leon Askin, who played General Burkhalter, were Jews who'd fled the Holocaust, while Robert Clary, Corporal LeBeau, had been interned at Buchenwald and lost his parents at Auschwitz. Still, Clary, the only living member of the cast, makes no apologies. "It was well written, well directed, and well acted," says the 93-year-old, whose concentration camp tattoo, A5714, is still visible on his left forearm. "It was a great group to work with. Bob never said, 'Hey, I'm Hogan, and I'm the star.'" But Crane was a star, and fame allowed him to indulge his appetite. Married to high school sweetheart Ann Terzian, and with three children, Robert and his sisters, Deborah and Karen, the actor used his celebrity to meet women, and then collected nude photos of them. "There were no drugs, no coercion, none of that," explains Robert. "Women just liked him, or found him handsome, or whatever it was. They would hook up." Aiding Crane in his sexual and cinematic conquest was John Henry Carpenter, a video equipment salesperson from Sony who was pals with Hogan's Heroes cast member and future Family Feud host Richard Dawson, and helped Crane acquire gadgetry to watch and make erotica long before the birth of internet porn. When asked about his co-star's addiction, Clary responds, "Hey, who cares? That's his problem. Why waste my time saying, 'How dare you like ladies?' That is dumb. Would not think about it. All we thought was, your life is your life as long as you're doing your job properly." Crane's sexual behavior did affect other castmates, though. After having an affair with co-star Cynthia Lynn, who played Clink's buxom secretary Helga in the first season, he moved on to her replacement, Patricia Olson, who stepped in to play the identical role of Hilda the next year. Olson, who went by the stage name Sigrid Valdis, became Crane's second wife in 1970, shortly after he divorced Anne. The couple had two children, Scott and Anna Marie. But Olson resented the influence Carpenter wielded over her husband, a dynamic captured in the 2002 film Autofocus, starring Greg Kinnear as Crane, William Dafoe as Carpenter, and Maria Bello as Patricia. Carol Ford, who co-authored Bob Crane, the definitive biography, and serves as an unofficial spokesperson for Crane's second family, says the movie overemphasized the star's fetish. As far as the amateur pornography, that was a small part of a bigger pie, you might say. Bob was chronicling and writing down and filming every single thing in his life. So when you look at it in the grand scheme of things, it's just a small slice. It was a slice that mainstream Hollywood couldn't tolerate. "He made some bad moves," Robert says of his dad. "He collected photographs of women and put together these books. Oh, here's Sally from Jacksonville, Florida." And then he started showing them to people. He was doing a very bad Disney film called Super Dad, playing an all-American character who cares about his daughter running off with some unsavory type. But at Disney Studios in Burbank, he's on the set showing photographs of women that he's been with to people on the crew. That hurt him because the executives found out. People talk, and it started getting in publications like the National Enquirer. The son maintains his father's sexual proclivities never veered into dangerous territory. To find out that the all-American Hogan has this, some people call it a dark side, but I don't think of it as a dark side, says Robert. "My dad loved women. I think he might have been overcompensating for the lack of a solid career in the final years, and maybe that fed his ego to meet a woman in a nightclub and they go out and sleep together. But I never looked at it as dark because it was consensual. There weren't hidden cameras or anything." Robert isn't embarrassed by his father's sordid enthusiasms. He still chuckles, remembering the time the Crane took him as a 21-year-old to the 1972 premiere of Deep Throat. He just loved it because he was meeting all these porn stars. But by then, Crane's star was fading fast. The culture had changed, and Heroes had ended its run the previous year. Work dried up for the middle-aged actor, who was soon getting by with gigs on the dinner theater circuit. By the time Crane got to Phoenix, his second marriage was on the rocks, and he was only scoring guest spots on shows such as The Love Boat. The actor bought the rights to a play called Beginner's Luck, a slight romantic comedy that he had performed at venues like The Windmill. 2 days before his death, he called his eldest son. "He was 2 weeks shy of 50, says Robert. He says, "I am making changes. I'm divorcing Patty." He wanted to lose people like John Carpenter, who had become a pain in the butt. He wanted a clean slate. That never happened. Robert believes that when his dad tried to pull away, Carpenter, who had followed the star to Arizona, became enraged. "They had a breakup of sorts," claims Robert. Carpenter lost it. He was being rejected. He was being spurned like a lover. There were eyewitnesses that night at a club in Scottsdale that said that they had an argument, John and my dad. A few hours later, Crane was dead. Scottsdale detective Barry Vassell was in Phoenix with a colleague on June 29, 1978, when he was called to Unit 132A of the Winfield Apartments. Several cops were already present, along with a dinner theater actress named Victoria Berry, who had arranged to meet Crane that day. Vassell then went to the airport to pick up Robert, Crane's business manager Lloyd Vaughn, and attorney Bill Goldstein, and brought them to the scene. The son believes what happened next compromised the hunt for the killer. Vaughn, Goldstein, and I walked through the apartment, examining, touching, handling items in plain view of Vassell, Robert wrote in his book. We added our fingerprints, footprints, and hair samples to an already contaminated, lackadaisically investigated, casually considered murder scene. Vassell, now retired from the force and a private investigator in Scottsdale, sees it differently. In a perfect world, you have a crime scene. Nobody's allowed in and nobody's allowed out. You only have one or two people in there. But that doesn't always happen. I don't think there was any contamination of the crime scene, which is what you really worry about. DNA testing wasn't available in 1978, but all roads lead to Carpenter, Crane's partner in porn. Not only did cops know that the pair had been fighting, there was no sign of forced entry into Crane's apartment, which suggested that the victim knew his assailant. But there was even more damning evidence than that. At the scene, there was blood everywhere, Vassil recalls. There were some traces of blood on the back of the exit door, the front door, the doorknob. There was a red stain on the curtain. We found blood in Carpenter's rental car and on the passenger door. It was Crane's blood type. Nobody else who handled that car had the same blood type as Crane. It was type B blood, all of it. But what cops found in Carpenter's Chrysler Cordoba wasn't enough. Absent a murder weapon, detectives couldn't persuade the county attorney to issue an arrest warrant. However, 12 years later, Scottsdale Detective Jim Raines uncovered a previously unseen crime scene photo that showed a speck of brain tissue in Carpenter's car. The actual tissue sample was long gone, but the image was ruled admissible by a judge, and Carpenter was eventually charged with Crane's murder in 1992. Prosecutors, though, had an uphill battle. DNA testing of the blood proved inconclusive, and witnesses came forward to say that Crane and Carpenter had a friendly dinner the night before the killing. Carpenter's attorney shot down speculation that a missing tripod could have been the murder weapon and reminded the jury that there was no proof of its existence. Meanwhile, Crane's predilections gave the defense plenty to play with. They suggested an enraged husband or boyfriend could have attacked the actor. Vassil doubts vengeance for an infidelity was a motive. Bob was a non-confrontation guy, and these women liked him, he says. I don't think I ever interviewed one that disliked him or was mad at him. In the end, there wasn't enough evidence to convict Carpenter, who was acquitted in 1994 and died 4 years later. We did the best we could, Vassil says. We went through all the evidence. We talked to all the witnesses that we could possibly talk to, and we came up with what we came up with. A lot of times when you have an old case like that, it's very difficult to get a conviction. It would have been a slam dunk with the DNA testing. In the years since, the star's family members have battled grief and one another. Before her death, Patricia Olson moved her husband's body from its original resting place to another cemetery without telling Crane's first family. Scott Crane is now focused on getting his dad inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame and has destroyed his father's massive collection of Polaroids and porn films. With them goes an intriguing part of a curious Hollywood career. Robert Crane does not speak to his step-siblings, and his mother and sisters refuse to talk about what happened so many years ago in blistering Scottsdale. It's bizarre to me, he says. I'm not expecting a let's hold hands at the table, but we've just never talked about it. And yet, like all the strangers fascinated by the sunny public life and mysterious death of Bob Crane, he cannot seem to let it go. I don't know what else to do, he says. Carpenter's dead, Patty's dead. Time is just taking people away. And speaking of time, we're out of time. Thank you for listening. I'm Rockin' Ron Schumacher from 103.5 WGRR, Cincinnati's Greatest Hits. Your Hollywood reporter. Look forward to being with you again next week. Have a great day.